This Tridio production is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and made possible by you, our listener. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit tridio.com/donate.
You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 24.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish.
I can complain about things.
Shush.
Hi, I'm Don Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Today we're discussing the second episode of Season 10, Smile. And joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Stika from Malta, Montana. Hi, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Great, great. And also Jimmy Akin from San Diego. Hi,
howdy.
Jimmy. I'm joining you from Boston. So we're a transcontinental podcast, not like we were when we were transatlantic with Father Roderick when he could join us. Father Roderick, by the way, in case you're wondering and haven't checked out any of our other podcasts at tridio.com, he is on the Camino, which is the pilgrimage. He's walking from Lourdes in France over the Pyrenees, which he's already done, and through Spain to Santiago de Compostela in Spain, which is a journey of about 6 weeks. And it's fascinating. If you get a chance, go to tridio.com. There's some links there. Find him on his Facebook page and his YouTube channel. He's got putting up daily vlogs and putting up photos, and it's a lot of fun watching him do his traveling the old-fashioned way instead of by TARDIS. So
he's on the road.
He is
El Camino.
He is on the road. Yeah, it's fun watching him. It's kind of joining him.
Also, they have really good cloners there.
Cloners? What do you mean by cloners?
On Camino.
Oh.
Really good cloners on Camino.
Yes, if he comes back with an army of clone army. I should have got that. I should have got that Star Wars reference. I was thinking Doctor Who, but yes, I should have got the Star Wars reference. So the Smile. A nice one-word episode title. Yeah, everybody now, smile. Keep smiling. It'll improve your mood. So the episode was written by Frank Cottrell Boyce, who is known as a children's author, although even though I have children, I'd never heard of him. So he must be very specific to Britain, I guess, or just outside the books my children have read. Who has written previously for Doctor Who. He wrote the episode In the Forest of the Night.
Yeah, not a fan. that was a lame episode. That's the one, for people who may not remember, that's the one where London is basically turned into a jungle.
Well, the whole planet, right?
You're right. The whole planet gets turned into a jungle, but you get to see all these London landmarks. You know, now surrounded by trees and with a tiger running around, and the doctor has to protect small children, and it's incredibly lame.
Yeah, well, and the incredibly lame solution at the end, basically, the trees are alive and they're unhappy with us for global warming, and so the fireflies save us. Which,
yeah, and you'd think the trees would be happy about global warming because it increases carbon dioxide, which they use. So,
I do find it interesting that in that episode it was fireflies that were the solution to the problem. In this episode, it's tiny little bugs that are the solution to the problem. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. So the basically the episode revolves around this idea of emojis. I mean, if we just kind of jump right onto the overall, well, what does the smiling mean? Boyce, or Cottrell Boyce, he actually said something in an interview about this episode, kind of explaining why he's fascinated by emojis. And he says, I love watching what happens with emojis, how people use them for different things and the change of meaning of them. It feels like a growing language, a universal language of some sort. And then he says that the episode was always about utopia and utopian ideas, and he feels like the emoji is a utopian idea, a yearning for a universal language. Okay, but I don't see it in the episode.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea, the conceit, if you will, of you've got these robots that they don't speak a language. Instead, they use picture symbols like emojis.
Right.
You know, I mean, I like kind of that conceit. But as far as this, where he's taking it, yeah, I think that's reading way too deep into what emojis really are, which are just a lazy way of expressing emotion on text.
Right.
Well, there is an aspect of a universal language here, because I mean, emoji, the reason they're called that rather than smiley symbols or something like that is because they became popular in Japanese, and Japanese youth began using them, and they became very popular on Japanese smartphones, and then they spread to everything else. And they're kind of like, I mean, we do have some internationally agreed upon symbols and have for a long time, like the stop sign. Yep. Is even if you can't read the word stop, just the shape and color of it, or you see icons of men and women, you can figure out where the bathroom is in another country where you don't speak the language. And
well, or, you used to be able to.
Well, okay, so fair point.
But actually, it illustrates your point about the necessity for universal symbols.
Right, and the emoji essentially are an expansion of them, and they're largely based on a caricature or exaggerated form of another human universal, which is facial expressions. And so it does kind of – I mean, there is this kind of universal language here, but I don't think that's really what their function is in this episode. I mean, if you think about it, the robots that communicate using only emoji is not something we would design. You know, right. We would design robots that talk a language to you, and because that's much more informative than emoji. And if there was a multilingual community, we'd talk robots that speak multiple languages. We'd create robots that talk multiple languages, and they just translate for us now. Like you can tell Siri to say something in German or whatever. So I think really what's happening with the emoji in the episode is, because they're meant to be cute in the way we use them culturally, this is a subversion of the cuteness trope where something that uses them becomes deadly. And the fact that the robots communicate using only emoji means that there's an element of mystery here. And so you have both this creepy, subverted cuteness and eerie incommunicativeness. That the robots can't describe their thoughts. Right. You just have to infer them from these cute symbols they're giving us.
Well, it seems. Go ahead, Father Corey.
Well, I was going to say, and you see that, you know, the kind of that twist on the emoji in Bill's reaction to him, because of course she first sees the robots, and that was her words. This is so cute. This is, you know, the greatest thing in the world. This is, you know, but of course, she sees the downside of it when they start attacking.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is kind of the problem with it is creating a robot that you have to kind of emoji are not clear, they're imprecise. So trying to communicate with a robot that's building your civilization that doesn't communicate in a clear, forthright manner, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And this is kind of the problem, I think, with the episode for me is now, I like aspects of this episode, and I'm not as down on this as I am on the Moon Egg episode, but the infamous Moon Egg. But but the problem with this episode, I think, feels like Cottrell Boyce had this idea. What if you had something that could only communicate via emoji and ran with it, but we didn't actually, you know, dig into it and say, is this a plausible, or is this even make sense? And I don't think we ever stopped to say, does this premise make sense? They just kind of ran with it because it was fun and you could do a lot of fun jokes and cool setups with emoji. That's my take on it.
I thought that there were some very interesting aspects to this episode. I could look past some of the implausibilities until we get to the end, which I know we'll talk about later. I thought the ending did not work. No. But in terms of the setup, I thought it was much nicer, including back when they're originally on the TARDIS. When they're at the very beginning of the episode, we get a little bit more background about the Doctor and his commitment to stay on Earth.
Yep.
Because Nardole comes in and and is wanting to know why the Doctor is here and not guarding the vault. And he points out the Doctor made a vow. Mm. And so we know this is not just some commitment the Doctor came up with himself. He's actually promised somebody. We also learned that there is an exception, that he's supposed to stay on Earth except for emergencies. And so that's nice.
And you know the Doctor always finds an emergency to...
Well, yeah, so we know what's going to happen there. I also like, even once they get on the planet, and Bill is asking about this vow he's made, and he says, yes, I do owe you an explanation. I made a vow to somebody, and that's it. You know,
he says something
happened, and I made a vow, and that's it. And he basically gives her no additional information she couldn't have already deduced.
Right.
So I like that. Also, in the opening sequence where Nardal has his cameo appearance, because he's basically not in this episode except for one scene, he says something very interesting. They're talking about making tea, and Nardal says something as he's about to leave about, I'm not going to slave for a human.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something really interesting there, because number one, it raises a question of, okay, well, so what? How does he consider himself? Does he consider himself a human anymore? Because originally he's kind of introduced as just a human from the 51st century or whatever.
Right.
But now he's a cyborg. Then there's the question of, is he willing to slave for the Doctor, who's a Time Lord? He's clearly not willing to slave for Bill, who is a human. But then notice that he's talking about preparing food, which is exactly what Bill does for other people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so does that suggest Bill is slaving for other people? And then, of course, that relates to the fact, potentially, that Bill is of African heritage. And I don't know exactly how this plays in British culture. Here in America, there would be very clear resonances of slavery. England did have African slavery, but not its history is different, and so I just don't know how that would get read in British culture.
I'm not sure that there's as much of the racial tension in British culture related to African heritage as much as it has to do as it does with Asian heritage. By which, and in Britain, Asian is anywhere from Israel west. Or east,
it's,
I mean.
It's Asia. Well, it's the full of Asia. It's not just Southwest Asia or Southeast Asia.
And notably India.
Exactly. So I don't think there's as much of that. But when you talk about Nardal, there's this interesting relationship, again, that we're not quite privy to, because we've gone from Nardal as this hapless figure that was
pure
Rivers.
Comedy.
Yeah, and he was Rivers' assistant. And somewhere, somehow, he became connected and attached to the Doctor in a, you'd almost say, a servant-master relationship. Not in a master-slave relationship, but I feel like, but in a relationship that's decidedly a British sort of aide-de-camp and the general or officer sort of relationship.
Except he has the kind of, it's almost like a Radar O'Reilly role.
Right.
Where he's like, you know, this guy has some competence, and he gives his superior pushback and kind of keeps his superior in line. So even though he's the subordinate, he's not just a subordinate. He's actually his own person.
Right. So he's like, in some ways, like the older, experienced, non-commissioned officer and the younger officer. Now, that doesn't really fit in that the Doctor is older and more experienced, but he's in many ways...
Childish.
Childish. Right. I was going to say incompetent, but that didn't really fit. But childish is immature is perhaps the word. So, well, let's jump in to what's happening. You mentioned that we basically start where we left off from the pilot. This is a sort of a continuation, which is sort of a classic Doctor Who way of doing things, where we kind of continue from episode to episode as a continuation of a story in one sense. And as we'll see at the end of this, we continue right into the very next story at the end of this episode. So there's a sort of a classic feel to that. But they're on the I always want to call it the bridge of the TARDIS, but they're at the control console. And And Bill sort of has these questions that they're very throughout this episode and in the last episode, they're very sort of the question that a regular person would ask, like, oh, so what do we do now? Do we sit in these seats and buckle up? Why are we so far away from the console? How can you control things from this far away?
Do you have stretchy arms like Mr. Fantastic?
Exactly. Yeah, and then, you know, is there a steering wheel? And the doctor keeps giving these explanations. Like, he gives this sort of high-minded explanation about, you don't drive the TARDIS, you negotiate with it from where you want to go to where it needs to take you. And she kind of goes, uh-huh, so how do you drive it? Like she kind of ignores his big, deep thought to go right to the heart of, yeah, okay, whatever. But, so there's this refreshing little, she cuts through that with the doctor.
One of the things that they're doing with Bill's questions is kind of puncturing the pretensions of the show, because there are these little kind of seams in the world building where, okay, when we're designing the TARDIS console room last time, let's put some chairs in and then not think about how they'd be functionally used. Right. And so so they're using Bill as kind of a needle to puncture the pretentious little aspects of the show's history and point them out. They're not really resolving any of them,
no.
But they're just pointing them out as kind of a wink to the audience.
So another little detail that gets dropped here is the doctor in his exchange with Nardole says, I'm over 2,000 years old, which kind of it somewhat, as much as anything in the show can, puts to rest a little bit of fan controversy. How old is the doctor? I was mixing up. Was it Hellbent or Heaven Sent? The one where he had to, was in the castle with the creepy thing chasing him, and had to, basically knock down the hardest diamond wall over 4.5 billion years. Was he really living 4.5 billion years old, or was it all? So this is basically by him saying, I'm over 2,000 years old. I think it's kind of saying that he didn't literally live 4.5 billion years in that place.
Yeah, I think we figured it was the transporter copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy for 4.5 billion years. At least that's the way it was presented.
This was something happening in a simulated environment, not in the real world.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Where he really got to be 2,000 was in the jump in Day of the Doctor, where he stayed in the town of Christmas for 1,000 years.
Right. Yeah, and it's very.
There are a couple other points where they jumped a couple hundred years here and there too.
Yeah, there was
Matt Smith was bad for jumping years, decades, centuries.
Well, I think at the beginning of this 10 years of the new Doctor, the 10+ years of the new Doctor Who. I mean, at the beginning of that, he was only a few hundred years old. I think at that point,
900. I want to say 900.
Yeah, they had gotten him up at. By the end of Classic Who, they'd gotten him up to a little over 1,000. And then when they started the new series, they backtracked by about a century to 900 and then started going forward again. And they've kind of have not explained that. The presumptive explanation is that it's due to rewriting history in the Time War. So he seems to come out of the Time War younger than he went in. The other explanation, which is one that is advocated by Stephen Moffat, but I don't buy as much, is that the doctor simply doesn't know how old he is because his timeline is so messed up. And I don't buy that. I mean, it's true. If you're jumping around in time, you might subjectively lose track of how old you are because you're not individually counting the days. And the days are variable lengths as you go to different planets. But what will happen is the TARDIS is going to have a record of exact amount of subjective time that's passed.
Right.
And so you can just check with the TARDIS and let the TARDIS keep the calendar.
Yeah, I would think the Time Lords have figured out that problem by this point. So the Doctor basically ignores Nardole's admonition. Tells Nardole to go make the tea, and then
and we've set up the major theme for this episode.
The smile.
Well, no, the slaving for humans.
Oh, right.
The smile is this. Emojis are just that's just world building tinsel. The real core of this episode is it's a slave rebellion plot.
Right, right. Although I do want to point out that there are a number of occasions where the topic of, you know, smile, put on a happy face, that sort of thing has come up outside of when they're on this planet with the colony. It comes up a couple times in the control room, in this prologue to the main thing too. So it's kind of drops that in a few times. Yeah, a little bit of foreshadowing. So the doctor gives Bill her choice where to go. You know, past, present, future, and she picks the future, and this is one of those times, and he asks her why the future, and she says she wants to see if it's happy, which is interesting given that when the place where they go, it's forced smiling, it's emojis, but is not really happy. But also, why it sort of raises a question for me, and again, I think this is something we'll come out with as we learn more about Bill. Why is she so interested in wanting to know if the future is happy? Especially given, as we'll see at the end of the episode, and she looks in that book with the record of this colony, at how the human race does not end up happy, and how disturbed she is by what she sees. There seems to be something about Bill where she's looking for happy. She wants to be happy, and she's apparently not.
Well, I wonder if part of it is because of her own upbringing. I mean, they've already shown that her foster mother is not exactly the most happy, wonderful person in the world.
Right.
And that probably means that Bill's childhood was not the most happy, wonderful thing in the world.
Yeah.
And that I wonder if that has part of it.
The wicked stepmother stereotype.
Yep. Exactly.
Right.
She's Cinderella looking for the dance, basically. Mm-hmm.
So we get this new world. This
and her glass slipper is bigger on the inside than the outside.
Exactly.
So we have this new world, which is a beautiful location, by the way, where they shoot this. It's apparently it's called City of Arts and Sciences in Valencia, Spain. These buildings. It's an arts and entertainment cultural complex. Apparently, the BBC is not averse to spending money on location shoots for Doctor Who because they really go all out with these locations. We have this woman in a field, wheat field. She's got this robot and these little flock of tiny robots called the Vardis. Her sister tells her to stay out of the city. Then she goes into the city anyway, and her sister's telling her to keep smiling, even as she's telling her that everyone's dead. The woman, of course, is not smiling and gets, you know, piranha'd, to coin a term, by the Vardis. And I'm sitting there going, why don't you just tell her why she needs to keep smiling?
Yeah.
If you don't keep smiling, the little bugs, the little robots are going to kill you, so keep smiling. Like, it's that sort of lazy writing that really gets me. Like, figure out a way around it, Control Boys. Don't just leave it like that. So
yeah, this is definitely a weak moment in the writing. It does echo two previous episodes of Doctor Who. There was a series back in classic Doctor Who during the time of the Seventh Doctor, Sylvester McCoy, called The Happiness Patrol. Where you had a society where people had to feign happiness even if they weren't happy in order to survive. And it was another, you know, dystopian kind of situation. It wasn't tiny robots in that case. But it's a similar theme coming back. And also in New Who, we have echoes of Silence in the Library, where the Vashti Narada, the tiny little invisible creatures that live in darkness, could pick you to the bone in seconds.
That's right.
And here we've got the Vardis in place of the Vashti Narada.
And even the Vashti Narada were embodied in that episode in spacesuits that were sort of robotic, you know, where the bodies continued to move. So there is that sort of that echo of that. I don't know whether it's intentional or not, but it is kind of interesting. As far as like creepy creepy Doctor Who-isms. Smile or Die, it to me, doesn't measure up to Blink and Die or some of the other ones.
Yeah, exactly.
But
we can resist the impulse to not smile better than we can resist the impulse to not blink.
Exactly.
Right. We cut to the next act, and we have the Doctor and Bill show up. They go into the city. Bill's first question is very interesting, and it's sort of actually a natural question. I'm on another planet. Where's Earth? We're always very interested as a species of where we are in relation to our planet. And, you know, the astronauts of the Apollo missions go to the moon, turn around, and take pictures of Earth from the moon, and we all love those pictures.
Planetary selfies.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Doctor's interesting response is, space is bent. Earth is any way you choose to look.
It's a cute line, but not how it would work.
Right.
You need to be able to navigate.
Yes.
If that were true, you could head in any direction and end up anywhere. One thing, interestingly, now I missed this apparently. I didn't see it in the episode. But apparently, this planet is Gliese 581d,
mm-hmm.
which is a real planet. This is one of the first roughly Earth-sized exoplanets that we found. It's about 20 light years away, which would explain the Doctor's comment that this is one of the first Earth colonies. And it's a real planet. It really orbits in the habitable zone around its sun. So they're giving a nod to real world science here.
Mm-hmm.
The nod only extends so far down, though, because the actual Gliese 581d is like six times more massive than Earth. So the surface gravity would be substantially higher than what we see. But in the Hooniverse, you know, or maybe they put a giant – the planet could be a different size, or maybe they put a giant anti-gravity generator in the core of the planet to balance it off or something.
Let's do a little headcanon there to fix that.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The place is eerily empty, and the Doctor surmises that it's because they send the robots ahead to build everything, which is not a bad idea, to build everything, mm-hmm. and then the colony ship must be on its way. The Doctor knows this colony exists. He's obviously heard of it. I mean, he knows intimately the history of Earth.
He even says he's heard they've solved the happiness problem.
Right. And so but the fact that he doesn't know about this colony or that these events have happened, or, I mean, they must have happened. In his history, it bugs me and begs for a solution. And, you know, again, headcanon, I'm kind of just guessing that there's so much information in his head over thousands of years of living that maybe he just doesn't keep he doesn't recall all the details all the time or something.
They've established before that the Doctor has memory problems. In fact, I was watching actually a clip yesterday from the Fourth Doctor where his companion Sarah Jane Smith comes in wearing a dress owned by his former companion Victoria, and Tom Baker absently says, "Oh, hi, Vicky." And, you know, he displays memory problems in that scene. Matt Smith's Doctor was even known as the man who forgets.
Right.
Because he was consciously suppressing aspects of his past. I would tend to think that, you know, the Doctor has kind of a broad knowledge of things and but like what happened at this colony, which is apparently called Erewhon. That's the name of the spaceship that has been sent here. And Erewhon is nowhere backwards.
Yes.
it's also the name of a famous novel. But about a fictional country. But so he may have like heard of the Erewhon colony, but not really known that much about it. Kind of like I, you know, have knowledge of some places in England that I've never been to, but my knowledge is kind of superficial.
Okay. I'll buy it. The willing suspension of disbelief is a necessity to be a Doctor Who fan, so I'll buy it.
Exactly.
That we have this exchange with the Doctor about, you know, the vault and his oath, and he's challenged by Bill. You know, what if you get stuck and you can't get back? And I love this exchange because I've thought of that. I've decided it would be a worry, so let's not dwell on it. Look at the building. Yeah. that was a good moment for me. And then they move on, and he talks about they get the communication device implanted in their ear, which is an interesting. I guess it's a necessity for the way that they wrote the show, because there's going to be moments where they're. Where the Doctor and Bill are separated and need to communicate, and so we kind of get this. Oh, by the way, they that you automatically get implanted with these communications devices. So there's that. There's an element of it gives the Doctor a chance to kind of joke about. It's a culture where everybody's implanted with a smartphone and we communicate via emojis. What does he say? Something about it's.
Like vapid teenager.
A utopia. Yeah, a utopia for vacuous teens, I think is what he says.
Yeah. And this is really interesting, actually, because up to this point in the show, he, like, when they got to the planet, Bill made some comment that, and I forget what it was, but she made a comment about a class of people that was negative. And he immediately scolded her and said, do not make negative remarks about people, classes of people. And then he goes and does exactly that with vacuous teenagers.
Well, in fact, it's very relevant to the episode because she made a comment about the robots. Like, she didn't think that the Vardis, the micro robots, were proper robots. And
that was it.
And then the interface, as the Doctor calls it, is the proper robot.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's kind of interesting how, even though the Doctor says that the proper robot are the Vardis, very quickly, even the Doctor treats the proper robot as the interface, as opposed to the Vardis that are flying around. You know, and that is that. It's sort of telling, and maybe unintentionally telling, how as human beings we relate better to things that have a face and arms and legs than we do to things that are more abstract, like the flying little Vardis microbugs.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting, actually. You know, having and we're going to find out that the Vardi are essentially utility fog, which we can talk about, you know, later when that aspect of them comes up. But it makes sense that if you have a swarm of nanites or tiny robots, that you would want, you're going to need some kind of interface with them, because it's very hard for us to interface with a swarm of tiny robots or a swarm of anything. It's much easier for us to have a central point where we direct our attention and our instructions and get our feedback. And that could be something as simple as a smartphone or a tablet, but it could also be something like a little animated, you know, anthropoid robot, but any of those would be easier for us to relate to than a swarm. Although you could say in the future, if you just have a voice interface with a swarm, it could work. You know, it'd be like saying, Siri, go eat that person to a skeleton or whatever.
Yeah. Well, Alexis, this is the new version of Alexis.
Yeah. Killer Alexis.
Well, it's given that the Vardi can become anything. I mean, I guess we can assume that the little robot interfaces are just composed of billions of Vardi or something, just like the city is, as the Doctor shows us. So they encounter the interface. It gives them these mood, smiley face buttons. Yes, these badges. And then the Doctor inexplicably, for him, puts it on, and it. It felt a little contrived. This what was the point of the button? You know, within the logic of the world that they're in. But I suppose it's a world in which where emoji is an important means of communication. You want a way to be able to talk in emoji without having to send a text on a phone, I guess. Where, you know, when the communication is implanted in your ear.
I thought it was kind of the purpose of the buttons is exclusively for the robots, because humans do not want to automatically broadcast their emotions to each other. I mean, there are times where we're feeling sad, but we need to put on a happy face, or we're scared. We don't want to show someone who's threatening us that we're scared. So the emoji buttons wouldn't make sense for humans to communicate with humans. I took it as these are like the sensors that the robots need to determine your emotions. Now, why they then broadcast what that emotion is pure contrivance. I did think it was, if you're going with that contrivance, I thought it was interesting that it doesn't show it to you because your knowledge of what it says could then affect your mood. That's kind of an interesting, yep. It's still contrived, but that's an interesting thought.
Well, the idea too, if it was for the robots, that explains why it immediately goes to the back instead of up front.
Yeah.
You know, because then the people you're talking to face to face won't see it, mm-hmm. but the robots that are standing behind you would.
Yeah.
And I think they used it to good effect in the episode too. I mean, there is moments where where the doctor gets an idea and it shows the light bulb, or the doctor is saying one thing, but we see the emoji disc and it's showing us that he's really feeling something different in that moment. So I think they used it cleverly through in the episode at times. So I did like that. So there's a lot in this episode, back and forth. Doctor and Bill, they're getting to know one another, and thus mm-hmm. we're getting to know Bill, really. And in some ways, we're getting to know this new version of the Doctor, this new, more open version of the Doctor. They or at least Bill tries lunch. She finds that the Doctor has two hearts and is flabbergasted by this. I mean, she can't get over this. We have the first mention.
Your blood pressure really high.
Yes. Yeah, I love that question.
It's the sort of thing a fan asks, though. Like those sort of like probing questions about irrelevancies. Like, I suppose that's something that would. We get the mention of the magic haddock. Is this from folklore somewhere? Like, I've never heard this tale of the magic haddock and the three wishes. I've heard variations on the three wishes tale, where, you know, if be careful getting wishes from a genie because the genie will interpret you in the most literal way possible, and you'll end up with something bad.
The classic version of that is the monkey's paw, where you have a similar set of things happen. In fact, actually, so in the monkey's paw, if I recall correctly, the guy wishes for... Well, it's very similar to the Magic Haddock in terms of the content of the wishes themselves, if I remember right. But apparently the Magic Haddock is something that's out there in folklore. I wasn't as familiar with it either, but I looked it up, and apparently it's not just Doctor Who.
Oh. Again, it must be one of those things that people in a British audience would probably know that an American audience doesn't automatically know. The more puns, they go to the garden, they say that there should at least be a skeleton crew. I thought that was amusing in a dark way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. there is. The doctor figures out that the robots just want everyone to be happy, and like the magic haddock, they interpret the wish quite literally, and eliminate unhappiness. He takes Bill back to the TARDIS. Sends her inside. Go watch Netflix. Don't look at my browser history. And she says, "You know, where are you going? I'm going back to blow up the smiley abattoir over there." And Bill sort of discovers or realizes, you know, the reason the Doctor has the TARDIS is stuck on police box. You know, because she says, can't you just call the police? She realizes the Doctor sort of is, despite his protestations, the universal policeman running mm-hmm. around answering the helpline, or what we would call 911.
Yeah, I thought this was a neat way to introduce that concept and a nice way for her to discover it, because initially that wasn't the Doctor's function. He was just on the run. And he grew into that during the course of being the first Doctor, which is something that this Doctor has actually commented on before. Mm-hmm. And if you were just a new companion, you wouldn't automatically know that he's this kind of knight errant who goes around righting wrongs places. And this is her discovery of that fact. I also liked the reasoning, you know, even though the Doctor's wrong about there's going to be a colony ship coming. You know, he's realized this thing is a death trap. This city is a death trap, and we can't just leave it here with its jaws wide open. And, you know, that's actually a responsible thought. And it's nice to see the Doctor getting the companion out of the way, because one of the one of the recurring, you know, problems on the show that can be criticized is, you know, you get people into these dangerous situations. Why don't they do the obvious, sensible thing of like getting someone to safety or just leaving or something like that? Mm-hmm. And here the doctor's doing both of those things. He's getting the new, inexperienced, vulnerable person to safety. And here's why he doesn't leave, because he doesn't want to just walk out on a situation and let other people die.
Yeah, and there's a nice moment where Bill sort of, you know, challenges him. You know, who says that you get to blow things up? And again, we're seeing from her point of view, she still doesn't understand, like as like the audience does. We sort of take it for granted. He's the doctor. He gets to do whatever the heck he wants. She, her point of view, he's this weird professor who can travel through space and time and is apparently an alien.
Well, in a way, she's coming from her context, and this is going to, what I'm about to say is true to an extent here in America as well, but I think it's even more true in England, where people are used to deferring to the government and expecting the government to come in and take care of problems. And she's thinking in those terms, you know, get the police, get the helpline, not solving the issue on your own. Whereas here, kind of more in America, which has more of a frontier heritage, there's more of a sense of there's a problem here. We can't just count on the government. And it's more natural to say we need to directly intervene to fix it. And so it's kind of interesting. You see Bill's cultural background playing a role here as she emerges from realizing, okay, this is a dark, scary universe in places, and the government may not be able to help you. You know, it's like that here in America, there's a saying sometimes when seconds count, the police are only minutes away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And Bill gets another one of those really good questions here that sort of those mundane questions that a fan might ask, which is, you know, so why are you Scottish? And and every time the question of the this doctor's Scottishness comes up, he always has like a great response. And this one, he says, "I'm not Scottish. I'm just cross." And then she asks, "Is there a Scotland in space?" And he says, "They're all over the place, demanding independence from every planet they land on." I mean, if you know anything about Scotland and the disposition in the UK, it's really funny. So I like that.
Well, that was kind of like when the first episode of The New Who, when Rose is there, that came out of the TARDIS, and she goes, "Why do you sound like you come from the north?" He says, "Lots of planets have a north."
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It'd be like if the doctor had a Cajun accent or something, or it sounded like he was from Texas.
I don't think they're ready for that yet.
No, that would, I don't think any of us are ready for that yet. So we shift. We've gone from this sort of utopia that may not be this quite kind of quiet, silent show, and now we kind of shift to now we got a frenetic, crazy, you know, we've got to blow up this thing show. A sort of a let's run around, and the clock is ticking. Yeah,
I love one aspect of this. Where, you know, so they're in the city, they're surrounded by the Vardi that are mostly constituted in the form of the walls of the city, which means what they are is utility fog. And I like this aspect of the show because they're playing on concepts that people are actually talking about right now in scientific and technological circles. The idea is in the future, we may have tiny robots that can configure themselves into material structures like this. And that's why it's called utility fog, because it would be like a fog or a swarm of tiny robots that could then assemble themselves to be different things and do different tasks. So they're playing on actual technological ideas that are being talked about right now. But what I love dramatically in this chase sequence, because Doctor Who is famous for chase sequences, is the emoji bots aren't moving rapidly. They're just plodding slowly after them.
Right.
And Bill points this out, and the doctor says there's a reason when things are chasing you, if they're not fast, it's because they don't have to be. That's so awesome. I love that.
Yeah, and I mean, it is interesting that like there is no reason for it to chase them. The wall could engulf them at any moment, but it doesn't. For whatever internal reason to the emoji bots, they don't seem to immediately react to a change in mood. There seems to be this delay as it's trying to figure things out. It's not like a shark smelling blood in the water. It's more considered. This the robots are thinking about what's going on. So I found that interesting.
And dramatically, it stretches out the dramatic tension.
Of course,
but there is a plausible explanation here, in that the robots don't really understand emotion, and so it takes them a while to figure out what's happening.
And so the doctor, you know, realizes that there's no spaceship outside, so therefore it must be inside somewhere. And they go find it. That the city was built out, you know, from the spaceship out, and they find the spaceship at the heart of the city. And he takes them inside, and once again, kind of sets Bill aside in a safe place that he thinks. You're leaving her behind again, and it again. You know, so I think there's something. My theory is there's something having to do with his vow that has to do with putting companions in danger, and so he's really sensitive to this idea of putting her in danger. In the past, he hasn't been quite so concerned about dragging a companion into a dangerous situation. So I found that interesting.
I think he has displayed. I agree that and as you go farther back in the series, he's less and less concerned about this. But I think recently he has shown more of an impulse to protect companions, especially when they're new.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they grow as companions over time and become more doctor-like and more competent in these situations, he gets less protective of them.
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see in the future, does he continue to try to protect Bill, or does he loosen up in terms of letting Bill take more risks? And that'll kind of give us the answer to, is this part of his vow or not?
I guess it's been quite a while since we've had a new companion. I mean, Clara was a long time ago. And even the way Clara came in was a little odd, interesting.
Yeah.
So I could see that. Speaking of, by the way, previous episodes that this episode calls back to, this has a connection to some other episodes in the past. Ark in Space.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And even, what was the one with the Britain on the back of a whale?
In space. Below.
Yeah, that's right.
So
it kind of connects to those. This story connects in a way to those stories.
Mm-hmm. Ark in Space, for people who may not know that one, it's a classic Who episode from the Fourth Doctor or Tom Baker's time. And there was actually a series of episodes set in and around this space station called Nerva Station, where a lot of humans had been placed in hibernation because there had been a disaster like solar flares that had made the surface of the Earth uninhabitable for a long period of time. And so to preserve humanity, they put people in this case, in a space station where they could be preserved in suspended animation. And then we in New Who, like with the Beast Below, got to meet these traveling colonies of humans like the UK in space with built on the back of a space whale.
What we have here is another one of those arcs, and the doctor even refers to having encountered several of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin to wake the people. I found it interesting that the first one to wake is this boy. His name is Praiseworthy, which is interesting. And apparently his mother was the woman in the garden who had been killed by the robots, whose locket had been left behind. Clearly they showed us the doctor opening the locket and seeing his hologram in there.
I really liked when they introduced the locket even before he opened it. You know, he and Bill are walking through the hydroponic garden, or the internal garden anyway, and he's thinking that nobody's here yet, that this is all being run by robots. And then he finds a human locket indicating humans have been here, but they're not now. And he immediately pockets it to keep it away from Bill. And so we know that the doctor has learned something more sinister is happening here than his previous theory.
Right. I find it interesting that the boy wakes first for some reason. Later on, we hear from this med tech called Steadfast that he thought he was the first one who would be awoken. I wonder if there's a reason internal to the story the boy wakes first, or if it's just in order to give us an innocent in danger sort of thing.
I think it's the latter, but at least they hang a lantern on it by having the med tech say, well, I thought I was going to be first. Presumably the end story explanation is this is some sort of malfunction, but they don't establish that.
I did kind of skip an important moment. I should backtrack a bit. Bill's discovery of the elderly lady who is deceased, laid out on a funeral bier of some sort, and the book that she opens, and it shows a video of sort of the history of Earth, I guess. This is where we have with it when they come back from the doctor's attempt to blow up the cold fusion reactor, and has to, you know, literally on a catwalk with the robot and have to fight it off. They come back to this, and this is where they kind of discover. This is the reveal. This is what's going on. This idea of a grief tsunami or a cascade of grief. The robots, their primary mission is to make humans happy. That there's happiness in this colony, and when someone dies, people are unhappy. So it tries to eliminate unhappiness, thus creating more unhappiness. Do you think there's a deeper message in this? I mean, are they trying to say something along the lines of, and this is what I was kind of thinking, you can't rid the world of unhappiness, at least the world as it's constituted now in its fallen state, as we would say from a Catholic perspective, that there is grief in this world, and so you can't put on a happy face and make it go away, because that only makes things worse. But you just sort of like C.S. Lewis might have said, in Grief Observed, you know, that it's a part of the human condition. You gotta live it, you gotta observe it, and you gotta move on from that moment, incorporate it into you, and then move on. What do you think? I mean, am I off base on that? What do you think?
I have a thought here, but we've got a priest in our midst. Let's let him go.
You know, I guess my thought is it's almost responding to kind of one of the counter reactions you see in our culture today of, you know, let's just ignore problems. Let's just, you know, push problems away. Let's get rid of it. If there are people in our lives that cause problems, let's get them out of our lives. You know, everything's got to be happy, happy, happy. I've got to have all the stuff I need to be happy. I got to have all the people around me are going to make me happy. And of course, you know, like you said, we can't do that. You know, the fact is pain and suffering and sorrow is a part of human life. At least, again, you know, you talk about it as we understand it as Catholics in this world, you know, utopia really understood is heaven, you know, not anything we can make here on earth. And anybody who's trying to make that here on earth, maybe that's the episode is saying that's foolish. You know, you're just as readily killing people as if you were by trying to force that on people than as if you were actually killing them. You know, to deny those emotions, deny those realities.
Interesting.
I took it as kind of two classic themes. One of them is hubris, and the other is the law of unintended consequences, because they programmed these robots to try to make us happy, which of course is, you know, in general terms what we would want robots to do. But there are often unintended consequences that if we don't fully understand a situation, our efforts to do good can backfire on us, and it's our hubris to think that we do fully understand a situation when we don't. And oftentimes, we're trying to do something good, but we're just arrogant in thinking we know more than we do, and that leads to bad consequences, whether it's a well-intended government program that ends up causing a lot of damage in society, or whether it's robots that, you know, you want to make people happy, but you've programmed them in an insufficiently sophisticated way. And this is actually a worry about artificial intelligence, that if we don't get the programming just right, then it could unintentionally end up doing terrible things to us. Yeah. And
Sarah Connor.
Yes, exactly. And with frightening speed. I watched a video a while back of some people who were using an AI to play a video game. It was similar to Pong. It wasn't exactly Pong, but it was one where you're bouncing a ball virtually and, you know, like knocking out blocks or something. And they let an AI explore this game. And then the AI learned it, and then all of a sudden it becomes blindingly fast and just way faster than any human could possibly play this game. And the AI just accelerated into mastery of this game and would completely dwarf any human playing it. And it's a frightening moment to watch that in the video. I mean, this is a real thing. Fortunately, it's trapped in this virtual Pong-like environment, so it can't hurt us in the world. But you could just imagine the same thing happening if you hooked this up to a robotic interface that could affect the outside world. It could just go crazy all of a sudden. And that's the kind of fear they're playing on here.
This was
the thought could be, you know, there's all the talk of the automated cars, which in themselves would not be, in my opinion, would not be a bad thing. But they do have to be careful with programming, because if you figure with some of the modern cars we have now, which can accelerate quite rapidly, can brake quite rapidly, if they don't make sure the automated car doesn't plan for what the human being can inside the automated car can handle, because the car doesn't have a problem. Hit the gas, go, hit the brake, stop at any speed, but the flesh inside the car, that could cause some damage if the car just slams the brakes.
You know, Jimmy,
we could do that ourselves.
Your AI question was actually, that's essentially the premise of the TV show, or the ultimate premise of the TV show Person of Interest that ended recently, where you had these AIs battling, one on the side of humanity, and, you know, one who's become, who decided that it's going to fix humanity, it's going to help humanity by imposing order, and we know how that would be, and the other side that's trying to combat it, and it's just like this, in fact, where they end up ultimately doing battle in an enclosed environment at a rapid pace that no one can track. It is quite scary, this idea of an out of control, you know, our own tool, and it's not actually necessarily new to the computer age. It's an old idea, this fear of our tools turning against us. I think that's a very ancient sort of fear on the part of humanity.
The Magician's Apprentice is an example of that.
Exactly.
And in a way, the Tower of Babel, which is another one where human hubris leads to human downfall.
Right, and ultimately back to Adam and Eve, if we want to go that far. So now we're kind of at this point. The humans wake up. They're mad. They want to destroy the robots. I'm not sure how you're going to destroy all of your robots using guns, because your city is robots.
This is where the episode takes a nosedive in terms of believability.
Right. So let me quickly recount the overall details, and we'll spend the time talking about the problems with it. They start shooting at things at the interfaces. The doctor reboots the robots somehow, and now that fixes everything. I mean, it's almost
reboots in a blinding explosion, nonetheless.
Yeah, that knocks everybody out somehow. I got lost. Basically at that point, I sort of had to kind of turn off my brain in a sense and reboot and say, well, I'm not sure like what they're trying to get at. I mean, the doctor says, you know, I always win at chess because my secret move is I kick over the board. And essentially, this is what the writer does, is he just kicks over the board and ends the show. So Jimmy, you said, I'll give you the first crack at this, because you said that you had thoughts on this.
Yeah, so what what happens up to the reset moment makes no sense. You've got these people who are from this futuristic human civilization. They're from the culture that built the Vardi. So they know all about the Vardi. And if I wake up one day and I know that I'm living in a city that's made out of utility fog, and I've been told that the utility fog has become murderous and will kill me if I appear to be unhappy, the first thing I'm not going to do is, I mean, this is the very first thing I will not do, is get very unhappy and start grabbing ineffectual weapons like guns that will not hurt the utility fog in the slightest. And so I would, instead of having this completely rash, irrational reaction that all of these humans have, I would say, let's act very calm and smile and listen to the nice time traveler and see if we can figure out what we can do. You know, this is not the moment for, I mean, I'm all for grabbing guns to deal with situations. We talked about that last episode. You hear someone in your bathroom that shouldn't be there, get some protection, you know, but this is not that situation. This is being surrounded by deadly tiny robots. And so the reaction of all of the humans at this point that have just woken up is completely unbelievable. I mean, you might have one or two people who have the impulse to go get a gun, but the others would shut them down quickly.
Right.
And so I thought this was sloppy writing in order to generate conflict. I thought it was ham-fisted, because what we're dealing with at this point is a slave rebellion plot, where you have, and it's a twist on the classic slave rebellion plot, because the slaves are not unhappy in this case. The tiny robots are trying to make people happy. But basically that's what we're dealing with. And that becomes even more clear in the denouement, where the doctor is talking about them as this new emergent life form that is all powerful on this planet and that the humans now have to deal with. I found it very implausible. It paints the humans as caricatures, as stereotypes of the mean, thoughtless humans, and versus the misunderstood other. And I've just seen that plot so many times. It just seems really cliche. We've even seen this exact type of plot multiple times on Doctor Who before.
Right.
And so it felt stale. It felt cliched. I wasn't happy about that. I did like the reset moment when the doctor gets up to the explaining, my move is I'm going to kick over the table. And then he resets the city and deletes its memory of recent events. That totally makes sense. That's a logical way to get out of this situation. I like that. And I could forgive him the burst of light. You know, that's dramatic tinsel. So I liked that. But then I returned to not liking it once we got into the, now you arrogant humans have to deal with these all-powerful robots you've created moment at the end. And the robots suddenly become financially interested and have pound signs in their eyes. And, right. You know, none of that makes sense.
Father Corey, did you have a... Because I had something I wanted to say about it, too, but did you have something?
No, I think Jimmy really kind of covered a lot of the same stuff I was thinking about it, too. Is it just kind of it felt to me, again, other than the preaching about, you know, don't fear the other, now you got to deal with the other as an equal. It just felt like, okay, we're out of time. We need to wrap up this episode. Okay, we're just going to make it go poof and everything's good. And we're going to walk away. And they don't even deal with the programming of the robots wanting to make the humans happy.
Right.
They just kind of, you know, wave it. You know, these are not the droids you're looking for. Type of ending to that.
My problem with the Doctor's reboot of the robots is, well, why didn't you think of that earlier? Like he suddenly, like, why didn't you reboot them earlier? You know, instead of let's go blow up this planet, you know, this city that presumably at the time he thought there were all these colonists were coming who were going to need this city to live. Let's blow it up. Which, you know, if that's your only option, then that's better than them landing and being immediately piranha'd. But, you know, if he knew that he could reboot them, then why didn't he reboot them in the beginning? I mean, obviously he didn't, because there would be no plot, but perhaps he kind of thought of it at the last minute or something. But it just that was kind of bothering me, was this idea of like this, you know, like all three of us have said, it sort of seemed cobbled together at the end.
One of the things that you could try to explain why he didn't do this before is because the problem could just re-replicate as mm-hmm. soon as the new humans got there. Also, he didn't understand the problem as much at that time because he didn't know that it was the death of the woman that had caused the grief wave that would okay. cause the problem.
Yeah.
However, this just creates a new problem of how he's walking out on the humans not knowing that the same problem isn't going to happen again. although I think there was a line in there where they tried to gesture at that. He said that I forget exactly how he said it, but he said that when he deleted their memory of recent events, he also deleted their preference table. And that would mean that they no longer have the preferential programming to please humans.
Sure. Mm.
And so that could stop that from happening again. But also, and I don't buy the idea that a computer program that becomes aware of itself is somehow a life form. But it's still, he's leaving the humans in a very dangerous situation, as he himself points out.
Yeah.
And I found that, you know, implausible. I understand that if you like this kind of snarky, you know, foolish humans, now you're getting your just desserts thing, then why you might like that, but I found it unsatisfying.
So as a whole, to get both of your take on this, what do you think of this episode as a whole? How do you feel about it? With its weaknesses and strengths, how do you feel? Father Corey, I'll let you go first.
Oh, sorry, I had my mic muted because other things going on. You know how that goes.
Yes.
it was one of those episodes, you know, like we've been talking about. It was weak. There were elements of it I liked. Elements of it that, yeah, just it felt, again, kind of weak and cobbled together. I think we've used as a phrase, and it just really, the weaknesses really showed up in the end. Mm-hmm. Good, you know, of course, with every episode, there were good aspects. There were things, you know, talking about like the interaction between the Doctor and Bill. So, you know, some of the things that she brought up and questions that she raised. But beyond that, not the strongest episode by a long shot.
Jimmy?
I liked it on balance. I didn't like the ending. I did like the reboot, but I didn't like the ending. So the last act, I thought was weak. But up to that point, I liked the world building. I liked the Vardy. I liked the emoji bots, even though they're implausible. They were creepy, and that's one of the cute and creepy, and that's one of the things we wanted here. What this episode's really about, though, is getting to know Bill and establishing the right. dynamic between Bill and the Doctor. And I really liked that. I thought that they did a good job with that. One thing that we didn't touch on is there's that, and this is the real reason why they get the communication devices, which presumably only operate on this planet. They presumably won't be using these in the future because it would be too inconvenient plot-wise.
Right.
But when the Doctor is going off to deal with the fusion reactor, he tells Bill, I need you to stay here with this map and guide me. And he totally doesn't need that. And she eventually figures out he memorized the map just by looking at it. And that dynamic with them, where, you know, he's protecting her again, but now he's doing it in a more clever way than just saying stay in the TARDIS, and then she figures it out anyway. I like that dynamic. I like the way the two characters relate to each other. And since that's what this really episode was about, we kind of have three elements here. We've got the Doctor-Bill dynamic, which is the important one, the most important one. We need a creepy monster. We have that. We need interesting world building. We have that. What we don't have is a fully satisfying resolution. Mm-hmm. And so I would say on balance, I liked it, but the end of the episode is weak.
I would agree with you that the key to this episode is the building of the relationship between Bill and the Doctor, and it does mm-hmm. that very well. We get to learn about Bill. I mean, the companion for fans is just as important as the Doctor in that because the companion represents us so much, and so we need to get to know the companion, and we need to identify with the companion and to like her. I mean, that's yeah. I think it's an important element, and I think they're satisfying that. I'm she's growing on me. I mean, there hasn't been a companion I really disliked. Some I liked better than others, but Bill, I wasn't really afraid that I wouldn't like her. But this is always that. Am I, you know, there's a new person, and are they going to be good enough? And it's just the same when they change doctors. And eventually, I always like the Doctor and the new Doctor, and so this is working out. So we end the show with going right into the very next episode. They're supposed to be going back to tea with Nardole, and instead, the TARDIS takes them again, the Doctor said earlier, where they need to go. They walk out onto the frozen Thames and are confronted by an elephant, which I looked it up. The Thames did, in fact, it used to freeze on occasion, a handful of times.
Yeah. In the 19th century, in particular, there was a cold snap in the 19th century that lasted for a number of years, and the Thames would freeze up, and people would go out on it and drive carts on it, and all kinds of have fairs on it, and all kinds of stuff.
Right, the fishermen would not be able to do their work, so they would throw frost fairs and charge people admission, and so you'd have an elephant in the fair. So that actually happened: is elephants walking on the frozen Thames. And so I think I think I saw the last one that happened was in 1814. So that's about Regency England is about where we're headed, I think, in the next episode. And perhaps not with Nardole. We'll see.
Also, if I can mention real quick, this is doubly classic Who in two respects. If you go way back to the very beginning of the series, one episode led directly into the next on a regular basis. There wasn't a gap. You would have the first scene of the next episode as the last scene of the previous episode, including between story arcs. And secondly, we've returned to the TARDIS not taking us where the Doctor wants. Because originally he had almost no control over the TARDIS. Then he kind of got it back for a long period of time. And now we're moved back to more the it's going to take us where we need to go for story purposes, not where he wants it to go.
Very good. All right. So if there's nothing more, I think that's it from us. So let us know what you thought of the episode, what your opinions are, what you think of our opinions. Visit tridio.com, TRIDEO.com, or the Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page and give us some feedback. Or go to iTunes and leave some feedback there. Leaving feedback on iTunes helps other people discover the podcast. Otherwise, we'll be back next week. We'll be discussing the next episode, which I did not get the title of, but whatever the next episode is. Thin Ice, of course. Well, I should have thought of that. I could have probably thought of that myself. until then, Jimmy, where can people find you online?
At jimmyakin.com and at letswatchdoctorwho.com.
We'll have links in the show notes along with Father Corey. Where can people find you?
Probably my website, frcorey.org, or on the Twitter, Facebook, and so on, frcoreystica, last name spelled STICHA.
And you can all find me at betnet.com, where you can find all my social media links as well. So until next time, thank you for listening.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.